Reconfiguring Law Reports and the Concept of Precedent for a Digital Age. Adherence to the rule of law entails a strong commitment to consistency, a belief that throughout a jurisdiction and across time, judges should treat like cases alike. For over a century, the judiciary's pursuit of this aim has relied principally upon printed law reports. With unsettling rapidity, digital technology has dislodged that system in practical fact, if not yet in the way that lawyers and judges talk and think about case law. In this lecture, the Ruschlein Lecture of Villanova University School of Law, delivered on April 18, 2007, I explore the gains one might hope for from a judicial consistency system designed to take full advantage of electronic case law dissemination, challenges confronting those who would seek to realize those advantages, and major forces of resistance. The lecture makes reference to a series of PowerPoint slides that can be downloaded from this site. If you haven't already downloaded them, you may wish to pause the lecture at this point and retrieve them before continuing. I will indicate the points throughout the lecture where the next slide is pertinent. I will also, however, quote from those slides where the text is absolutely critical to an understanding of the lecture. In other words, having a copy of the visual component to this presentation is not essential to understanding the lecture.
Connected to the rule of law, entailing a strong commitment to consistency that throughout a jurisdiction and across time, judges should treat like cases alike. As expressed in standard formulations of the importance of following precedent or adhering to the rule of stare decisis, this is not so much a product of a belief that law should not change, but of views about the proper judicial role.
Next slide. William Blackstone. It is an established rule to abide by former precedent where the same points come again in litigation, as well to keep a scale of justice even and steady, and not liable to waver with every new judge's opinion. As also, because the law in that case being solemnly declared and determined what before was uncertain and perhaps indifferent, has now become a permanent rule, which it is not in the breast of any subsequent judge to alter or vary from according to his private sentiments.
Given the spectacular variety produced by U.S. federalism, attempts to describe or analyze the operation of precedent or any other element of judicial function confront a daunting challenge. The difficulty is compounded during periods of rapid change.
Next slide.
Forming a composite of all 50 states is not especially useful. History, size, and countless other variables invite but also vex attempts to categorize them. That may be one of the reasons that legal scholars so often focus on federal law and the federal courts. But on this topic in particular, that's not an appropriate strategy. So in this exploration of precedent, law reports, and digital technology, I have decided to concentrate largely, though not exclusively, on a single illustrative state. That anchors us in concreteness, but allows us to draw comparisons with other states. But which state? The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania suggested itself to me initially, but I worried that some of my observations might be taken personally. To minimize that risk, I now direct your attention some 1,000 miles to the west.
Next slide.
To a state with no connection I know of to this audience, smack dab in the middle of the country, Kansas. Selection of Kansas is arbitrary but defensible. It's not only in the middle geographically, but it lies toward the middle of the 50-state spectrum on a variety of other counts. It's neither unusually large or small in population. The number of lawyers, again, is on neither extreme. The Kansas judicial structure has no idiosyncratic features, and like most jurisdictions in the United States, it has not to date made any meaningful adjustment in the dissemination or treatment of precedent in response to digital technology.
Next slide.
The Kansas judicial system looks like this. The important layer are the district courts, spread throughout the 105 counties in the state. They are augmented by a layer of municipal courts that adjudicate traffic infractions and other ordinance violations in the incorporated municipalities. And each county in the state, returning to the district court level, ranging from Greeley with 1,500 population to Sedgwick with 500,000, each county is served by at least one district judge.
Next slide.
To hear appeals from the district court level, one moves up to a two-tier appellate structure. A court of appeals established in 1977 and a Supreme Court which can trace its origins all the way back prior to statehood. During fiscal year 2005, the Kansas district courts disposed of approximately 500,000 cases. 36,000 criminal cases, more than half of them felonies, a comparable number of domestic relations cases, and over 175,000 civil cases of other kinds. Throw in the municipal courts, the administrative adjudications in the states that are appealable to the district courts, and I hope it becomes clear that achieving consistency in the application of law throughout this complex structure, the ultimate task of precedent, is an enormous challenge. There is, of course, the right to appeal, but that standing alone, unassisted by doctrines of precedent, is far from being efficient. Appeals are filed in less than 0.5% of all cases heard by the Kansas District Court. Precedent at once extends the reach of that relatively small number of precedents and limits their necessity. By its operation, any time any Kansas court, trial or appellate, confronts a question on which it or some other Kansas court has previously ruled, precedent applies. The terminology used varies, but most scholars draw a distinction between two applications of precedent, and I will point them out to you here. First of all, there are horizontal applications of precedent, and that is when the same court speaks across time to itself.
Next slide.
Here is the Kansas Supreme Court speaking of the obligation to follow its own precedent.
Com v. Arkansas River Gas Company, 1927. We have not failed to note the more or less analogous case from other jurisdictions which the diligence of counsel has brought together for our perusal, but due respect thereto, we are bound to follow our own precedents.
In this mode, precedent aims for consistency across time, through changes in judicial personnel, and in some settings where there are multiple panels of a particular court, from one panel to another. Then there is vertical application of precedent, and that expresses the hierarchy in court structures. When a Kansas lower court adheres to prior holdings of a superior court, the Court of Appeals follows a decision of the Supreme Court or the District Court, that of the Court of Appeals, precedent is said to be operating vertically.
Next slide. Noon v. Chalet of Wichita, a Kansas Court of Appeals decision, 2004. We are duty-bound to follow Kansas Supreme Court precedent unless there's some indication that the court is departing from its previous position.
And then there's the lay understanding of precedent. Judges often use it this way, and scholars occasionally do. When a legal question arises and there's neither vertical nor horizontal precedent, a court may still speak of a decision of another court, one that has no obligation to follow as precedent, meaning simply that the situation it faces is not unprecedented, that it has a decision template available for consideration, adaptation, and use.
Next slide. State v. Wyman, 1967. The defendant cites two cases from foreign jurisdictions. Neither case supports the defendant's position, for the statutes involved are different from our own. Consequently, neither provides any precedent for us to follow in the instant case.
This 1967 decision of the Kansas Supreme Court rejects decisions from other jurisdictions cited to it as not precedent in this looser sense because they dealt with a different kind of statute.
Next slide.
Now, in all of its meanings, precedent depends on an information infrastructure. For a judge to consider and to apply a prior opinion as precedent, she and lawyers arguing a case before her must know about it. But how is that essential predicate for precedent achieved? This lecture concerns the information systems past, present, and near-term future that support and constrain the operation of precedent. In critical ways, the current American ideas about precedent are a product of print law reports, the systematic publication of the decisions of America's appellate courts, which arose in the 19th century and flourished during the 20th, was as much a source of this country's distinctive views of precedent as a consequence of them. Inherent limits of that mode of dissemination have influenced what counts as precedent and what does not, and this has only become evident as in the recent past we've shifted from print law reports to electronic distribution. Taking consistency of judicial decision-making as the end toward which doctrines of precedent are merely ends, the ultimate question toward which we are headed this afternoon is how ideas of precedent might be reshaped in the light of this radically altered reality. But before reaching that provocative question, I think I need to explain my assertion that current concepts of precedent and limits inherent in print law reports are linked and identify some of the problems I see arising from the continued use of print-based ideas and practices now that case law flows along electronic channels.
Next slide.
In a judicial system that functions like ours, for past judicial opinions to have an effect on future ones, it's not only essential that those opinions be readily accessible to judges and lawyers presenting them, but unless all are quite literally reading from the same page, there has to be a system of citation enabling precise reference to those past opinions and specific passages within them thought to be pertinent to the present controversy. For over a century, the mode of information dissemination that fulfilled these related requirements and thus provided the infrastructure for precedent rested upon judge-written opinions presented in publicly arranged print law reports. Law reports produced in this fashion set U.S. practice apart from its historic antecedents. It was in 1817 that Congress authorized the first official reporter of decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. By the end of the 19th century, nearly all states in the United States had established publicly sponsored law reports to disseminate the opinions of at least their highest court.
Next slide.
Key elements of the law report system, the public law report system, can still be seen etched in the statutes of a number of states, including Kansas. These include requirements that appellate judges write opinions rather than have their opinions taken down as they deliver them extempore. Deliver them in timely fashion to a salaried public official, the reporter of decisions. An enumeration of the editorial responsibilities of that public figure, the reporter of decisions, such as adding tables of contents, index, syllabi, names of attorneys, perhaps more. And finally, a charge that the reporter oversee publication typically in two ways. First, soft cover advance sheets, later permanent hardbound volumes. And last, not least, distribution at public expense to the jurisdiction's judges at all levels and sold, often at a controlled price, to lawyers and libraries.
Next slide.
The details vary from state to state. The underlying policy premise is clear. The effective and timely distribution of precedent is a public responsibility.
Next slide.
A related public responsibility widely accepted but not so effectively or thoroughly implemented by the end of the 19th century was the establishment of a system of public law libraries. Individual 19th century lawyers did have their own libraries, but most lawyers required access to larger collections than their practice could afford. And judges often needed to consult more than the case law of their own jurisdiction. The earliest response was subscription or membership law libraries. The first was the Philadelphia Social Library, established in 1802. Membership libraries spread to other eastern metropolitan centers and followed settlement to the west. But while such libraries were established, met the needs of their members, the desire to have a core collection for the use of judges, other public officials, and lawyers to whom subscription libraries were not available led to the creation of publicly funded law libraries. By the end of the 20th century, many states had, at least as Nebraska has here, established systems of state and county libraries. In 1972, there were over 1,000 of them. Now, have you noticed me slipping into the past tense? That was intentional. In a large number of states, though not Kansas, public law reports have disappeared and had disappeared before the dawn of the digital age. The lower federal courts never had them. And while public law libraries were appealing in concept with some conspicuous, largely metropolitan exceptions, they never achieved the reach or quality to which their supporters aspired. Chronic funding difficulties plagued their effectiveness long before online legal information rendered them obsolete.
Next slide.
And here's what did public law reports in. Public law reports had trouble competing with parallel commercially produced law reports which emerged toward the close of the 19th century. For a short time, there was fierce competition. But by the early 20th century, West Publishing Company, its national reporter system, had swept aside or acquired all rivals. Commercial reports initially pushed public law reporters to expand and improve their editorial editions, to move decisions to print with greater speed, to publish advance sheets if they hadn't before, and to conform advance sheet pagination to that in the final volumes. But the public entities responsible for law report publication and distribution were all too often prevented from matching West's performance by limited funds, insufficient staff, inferior printing technology, and general legal constraints on public contracts and sales. They had no pricing flexibility, and critically, most were unable to respond to the surge in demand for back volumes produced by the growth of lawyer population in the United States. Supreme Court copyright decisions effectively blocked state efforts to reserve or grant exclusive publication rights. As a consequence, West Publishing Company traveled an unimpeded path as it produced its comprehensive national series of reports. Courts commonly insisted that those citing precedent to them refer to the volume and page number in the official reports, but West was free to insert those citation parameters in its volumes. Its inclusion of star pagination in the national reporter system allowed users to cite to official reports without acquiring or even having access to them.
Next slide.
With the exception of West's reports covering the lower federal courts, the national reporter system sought simply to match the coverage of the public reports. For most states, at the turn of the 20th century, that simply meant publishing all decisions with full opinion by the jurisdiction's highest court. For during the formative years of public law reports, only the federal judiciary and a handful of states had multiple level appellate structures with an intermediate appellate court situated between trial and the highest court. During the latter half of the 20th century, however, growing caseloads led more and more states to adopt this model, as Kansas did in 1977. By the end of the 20th century, approximately three-quarters of the states had intermediate appellate courts. Decisions of these new courts were fed into the law report system, state and commercial, but not all of them. Most states setting up intermediate appellate courts specified that only selected decisions from that layer of the judiciary should be published. And the federal judiciary followed suit. Selective publication of U.S. Court of Appeals decisions began, or at least became a publicly acknowledged practice in the latter half of the 20th century. The important thing is that decisions withheld from public law reports under such policies were listed in the West National Reporter System as so-called table cases, but not printed there either in full. A court's decision not to publish an opinion effectively kept it out of both the official and the commercial precedent distribution channels. Being invisible, it could not operate as precedent. Invisibility was also the fate of nearly all trial court decisions. In those few jurisdictions where some were published, the criteria for publication were stringent, the allotted space quite limited. Here, too, the coverage of West's national reporter system simply tracked the official reports. As I've noted, the force of competition from West's national reporter system ultimately led many states to seek publishing their own. Those who needed access to the multiple jurisdiction coverage of the West reports, a group that included ever more judges and lawyers, particularly as federal law and decisions climbed in importance through the first half of the 20th century, to them, public reports seemed costly and redundant, even when they were timely and well done, and with reports and advance sheets that were in many cases swifter to arrive, system of summarizing and headnoting that strung decisions on the same issue together, not only within a jurisdiction but beyond, and a strong reputation for accuracy, West offered an information package with which no state could compete. Moreover, the market warranted, the company was more than ready to produce a single jurisdiction offprint of its regional reporter so that courts, lawyers, and libraries that served them didn't have to buy the case law of other jurisdictions in order to have multiple sets of its own.
Next slide.
Beginning with Florida in 1948, a parade of states, including three-quarters of those surrounding Kansas, joined the lower federal courts in ceding all law report publication to West. The step reduced state payroll and got the state out of the business of storing and distributing law books. It also shifted the judiciary as well as all other units of the state government into a dependent posture, buyer of the state's own precedent from a single source. By the mid-1990s, nearly half the states were openly dependent on West for their law reports. Others quit law report publication less conspicuously. The Pennsylvania law reports prepared by a state reporter reach back to 1845. How many of you are aware that for over 30 years they've been published by West? Now, Thompson.
Next slide.
Volume 40 of 58 was prepared by Joseph W. Marshall, state reporter, published under his supervision. And it was his last. He retired.
Next slide.
Volume 459 was published by West and included the summaries and headnotes prepared by its editors for the Atlantic Reporter. Similar shifts to what might be called joint or cooperative publication took place in other states, which viewed from a distance might be seen to have maintained independent production of their own reports. In sum, by the end of the 20th century, public control over and responsibility for the distribution of precedent had been severely compromised by the effectiveness and market dominance of a single system of commercial print reports. And in large part, as a consequence, the judiciary's need for law reports had in most jurisdictions led to a tight working relationship with West and a deep level of dependence on the proprietary methods and format of its reports. As it felt necessary, West was not shy about reminding states of that.
Next slide.
1998. It was less than a decade ago that serious alternatives to libraries of print law reports first became available to judges, lawyers, and others in the United States. The two major online services, Westlaw and Lexis, of course, do reach back to the 1970s, but for most of their history, these were case-finding tools, supplementing but not substituting for print reports. By the mid-80s, the Lexis threat to add star pagination keyed to the West National Reporter system to its case data raised the prospect of researchers working mostly, if not totally, from electronic versions of the printed volumes, but that provoked a West copyright suit. By the time the parties settled in 1988 with a cross-licensing agreement that allowed Lexis to insert West pagination at a heavy price, Westlaw had itself added pagination. But it wasn't until the late 1990s that these systems attained the scope and the functionality necessary to transform them from places to begin case law research into total research environments, virtual libraries.
Next slide.
It was competition from CD-ROM-based law products in the early 90s that spurred major software improvements, building up the comparative advantage of these electronic workspaces over print that produced an important step forward. One was hypertext, or hyperlink references, standard in the early law CD-ROMs, but not an easy transplant onto the character-based, non-scrolling terminal interface with which Lexis and Westlaw users at that time had to cope. Downloading a full case from either of these systems in the early to mid-90s had to be done by the screenful. The ability to scroll up or down through a full text of an opinion, save it, and print it in its entirety was only fully realized when Westlaw and Lexis moved to the Internet and to a web browser interface, and that was 1998.
Next slide.
At roughly the same time that Westlaw and Lexis succeeded in putting case law research on the desktops of lawyers in large firms, new players with new business models commenced to bring electronic case law within the budgets of small firm lawyers. And here, too, CD-ROM technology was an important catalyst. Through the early 1990s, Westlaw and Lexis offered more than most small firm lawyers needed at prices they couldn't afford. Charging in ways that made the respective services unattractive to lawyers who made repeated use of the cases and statutes of a single state. In 1995, Law Office Information Systems, LOIS, began selling state-specific CD-ROMs for a flat $600 a year.
Next slide.
By 2000, a striking array of less costly research options were available to United States lawyers, including, importantly, those practicing in small firms. LOIS, by then LOIS Law, had moved to the Internet and expanded to all 50 states. It was underpriced in some jurisdictions by small CD-ROM publishers and everywhere by Versus Law.
Next slide.
Offering a national online case law library priced at $83.40 a year for a solo practitioner. Lexis and Westlaw responded with fixed-rate plans designed and priced for small firms.
Next slide.
By then, free, public, nonprofit, and advertising-supported sites were offering law over the Internet. More recently, state bar organizations have become major players in the case law dissemination picture, contracting with a still newer set of commercial providers on behalf of their members.
Next slide.
Do you know Casemaker? Casemaker has led this movement, the Casemaker Consortium, established by the Ohio Bar Association and a small electronic publisher. Bar groups join the consortium and then provide its service as a free benefit to their members. Currently, Casemaker claims 26 state bar association members, the most recent to join, Kansas, in late 2006. Casemaker is the best member benefit the state bar has ever offered. It's worth more than my annual membership dues. And that's testimony of countless bar members in the 26 states.
Next slide.
A second entrance using this business model, and as well a search engine that has learned some lessons from Google, is FastCase. In the past 2 years, FastCase has signed up 7 bar groups, 4 large voluntary bar association or membership libraries, and several trial lawyer groups. As the market for legal information has sped through these rapid changes, network computers have moved to the desktops of nearly all lawyers and judges, providing a writing space, communication channel, scheduling and management tool. Most writing done by lawyers and judges, memoranda, briefs, judicial opinions. Most writing is composed and revised at a computer. Most case law research by those on both sides of the bench is done there as well. Lawyers, young and old, write briefs without ever pulling a law report volume from the shelf.
Next slide.
And libraries. Libraries pressed for shelf space and funds have ceased acquiring new volumes and even gotten rid of old ones. Today, no judicial branch of a state government lacks a website.
Next slide.
Most disseminate decisions of the courts of the state on the day of release, the appellate courts, to the legal profession, to the press, the broader public. But in critical ways, those sites, the decisions they hold, and the professional practices of lawyers working with them remain tightly bound by the concepts and premises of print law reports. The widespread failure to adjust to the new virtual reality casts large, diffuse costs upon the nation's judicial systems and those who appear before them. And so long as judicial dissemination of precedent is in digital form subordinated to print, important changes made possible by the new technology cannot be realized. to identify some of those costs and as yet blocked opportunities. Let's go back to Kansas.
Next slide.
In Kansas and most U.S. jurisdictions, cases are still cited to printed reports, those of the National Reporter System, and whereas in Kansas they still exist, public reports as well. I don't need to track that citation for you, do I? Volume, reporter, page. The page is where the relevant passage is to be found in the reporter, and followed by a parallel reference to the National Reporter System.
Next slide.
Since the system depends on volume and page numbers, there is a significant period during which any citation to a case is incomplete or temporary. It will be 3 to 4 weeks before this April 13th State v. Cole decision of the Kansas Court of Appeals, currently retrievable using the state website, will receive its volume and page number assignments in the National Reporter System on Westlaw. Those waiting for print advance sheets will have to wait several weeks longer. Another 3 months will pass before State v. Cole acquires its official Kansas Court of Appeals report citation, or at least before that citation is added to Westlaw and Lexis. Now, lawyers, judges, law students, and scholars have coped with this citation gap for as long as there have been law reports. But because of the Internet and court websites, it need no longer exist. Furthermore, because of the diversity of electronic distribution channels today, the gap is amplified, and the inconvenience and cost of retrofitting print-derived citation information to digital opinions is multiplied. To eliminate the delay and these costs, Kansas, as well as the 30-odd states and the federal courts that have not done so, need to do what over a dozen states have done, and that is implement a system of court-attached citation that doesn't depend on where a decision ends up being placed in a set of books.
Next slide.
Last week, the North Dakota Supreme Court decided several cases, and they will in a few weeks be given a volume and page number in the National Reporter System in Westlaw. And that information will slowly ripple through the other online services. But from the moment of release and forever thereafter, this and those others can be cited using a system illustrated by Odin v. Rath, 2007, North Dakota, 51, paragraph 18, year, court, decision number, paragraph. Auden is now in Lexis, Westlaw, Casemaker, and the rest, and can be retrieved in all by its medium-neutral, non-print-dependent, non-proprietary citation. As long as decision citation information and other revisions are added after initial release and authoritatively implemented in only one among many disseminators, all the others must somehow secure that information and incorporate it into their versions of the same decision. This injects expense, time lag, risk of error, and in the case of proprietary citation or pagination like West's, licensing costs or litigation risk.
Next slide.
That leads to a second lesson Kansas can learn from North Dakota and several other states. The website to which the Kansas appellate courts release their published opinions carries this notice. Consult the bound volumes of Kansas reports and the Kansas Court of Appeals reports for the final, official opinions of the Kansas Supreme Court and the Kansas Court of Appeals. The print reports remain the official dissemination path. The lengthy period prior to final publication is an invitation to the court for editorial and even substantive revision. And this notice warns users and publishers that the versions of the opinions publicly accessible via the website are not subsequently conformed to the final revised official versions. Relatively few states have to date realized the importance of posting any revisions at their websites when they occur.
Next slide.
A third and related problem. Because decisions are not final and citable when released, lawyers and judges have no assurance that they are working from the same page, virtual or print. Print may be the official channel for Kansas precedent, but most lawyers and judges in Kansas, like elsewhere, draw case law from one of the competing virtual libraries. The judiciary's failure to release appellate decisions electronically in official, final, citable form gives rise to an indeterminate risk that different online versions may be inconsistent. And there's no ready means of verifying the accuracy of a critical passage other than tracking down a copy of the print version. Kansas Supreme Court and Court of Appeals judges all use Westlaw. Contracting practices vary from state to state, but appellate courts across the United States subscribe to Westlaw, Lexis, or both. And let me underscore appellate courts. Because funding for library resources and electronic legal research services for Kansas District Court continue to lie on the state's 105 counties, and those counties vary enormously in scale and resources, the online research services available to trial judges in Kansas range from Westlaw or Lexis to none. State monies continue to bring a copy of the print reports to every district judge, but there's no effective assurance that they or the lawyers appearing before them will have access to as complete a collection of Kansas precedent as the judges who establish it. Like lawyers across the United States, those in Kansas constitute a complex market. Type and prosperity of practice, size of firm, location lead to quite different decisions about online service. But there's now a baseline. Like lawyers in a majority of states, those in Kansas who are members of the state bar have access at no additional charge to Casemaker. And for them, Casemaker has replaced the county law library. It's therefore all the more troubling that there's no official digital data source from which Casemaker can draw or against which it or any other online service can authenticate their data.
Next slide.
A fourth problem with living still with print paradigm in a digital world. By bestowing official status on one set of print reports and in other less obvious ways, court systems can, and some do, trade special access in return for discounts in their bills for legal information online and in print, for editorial and technology support, and even for cash. Kansas publishes its own official reports, but the majority of states that still nominally produce law reports outsource their publication. And over the last decade, contracts for official report publication have concentrated in two companies, Thompson West and LexisNexis. In states like California, New York, and Ohio, where the demand for legal information is high, these contracts, New York's is depicted here, which afford the commercial publisher privileged access to final decision texts and official citation data in digital format, these contracts have become a mechanism for extracting substantial benefits for the judiciary, including free or discounted use of the publisher's online system. Since the Westlaw contract for the Kansas appellate courts has a non-disclosure provision, I can't tell you whether its price terms are tied in any way to the court's active cooperation with Thompson's production of the Pacific reports or its securing Westlaw data from Kansas. But I can tell you that such provisions exist in Thompson's contracts with other states.
Next slide.
In this way and others, continuing to tie precedent to print reinforces the market positions of the two dominant legal information vendors, Thompson West and Reed Elsevier, to the detriment of smaller competitors. It enables Thompson West to use the century-long judicial and professional acceptance of its national reporter system and the resulting network effects, consistency of format, an indexing or editorial scheme that allows one to go back over the full expanse of a jurisdiction's case law and out of the jurisdiction, a citation scheme deeply ingrained in both habit and practice norms, to maintain its leading position in the market for online legal information. LexisNexis, working under undisclosed terms of its cross-licensing agreement with Thompson, is able to come close to Westlaw in the timeliness, comprehensiveness, and citability of its case law collection, and surpass Westlaw in other ways. Through aggressive price competition, Lexis has secured substantial numbers of judicial subscription, and measured in revenues, though not necessarily in users, it's a strong number two among lawyers. The lower cost vendors, on which many small firm lawyers rely, either don't include essential citation information and post-release revisions versus law, or include volume and page number information, but only long after it's appeared in Westlaw and Lexis, obtaining that and any post-release revisions by redigitizing decisions from text. In the case of Casemaker, the delay is 8 months.
Next slide.
Reform is feasible. Reform is easy. During the mid-1990s, a series of reports urged the nation's court to attach full medium-neutral citation data to decisions before release, and to revise the rules governing citation in briefs and memoranda to require use of this non-proprietary scheme. They were also urged to create digital archives holding all their case law in final, citable, official form. Archives open on equal terms to all publishers and members of the public. Today, these companion reforms can be seen at work in several states, at work and accessible via websites that feature capable search engines, other case-finding tools, and complementary elements of functionality that make them useful tools for direct public dissemination of precedent, and tools that enable frictionless distribution by all commercial players. These are totally feasible foundational reforms that Kansas and other states still stuck in the print law report paradigm need to make. And making them opens up a whole new set of possibilities.
Next slide.
Print law reports are costly to produce, to distribute, and to store. Consequently, print precedent dissemination encourages, if it doesn't force, selectivity. As reported earlier, whether or not state high courts engage in selective publication, the addition of intermediate courts of appeal typically brought policies limiting publication of their decisions. In most states, the decision not to publish a decision effectively denied access to it. And because of serious issues that would arise, were unpublished and therefore invisible decisions to be nonetheless binding precedent, most jurisdictions declared unpublished decisions non-precedent. Kansas court rules divide appellate decisions into two categories, published formal opinions and unpublished memorandum opinions. Decisions are only placed in the first category if they address new issues or otherwise thought to have value as precedent. Memorandum opinions are not binding precedent, and their citation, not forbidden, as is the case in some states, is nonetheless said not to be favored. Half the decisions rendered by the Kansas Supreme Court, 90% of the decisions rendered by the Kansas Court of Appeals, are non-precedent, unpublished decisions. In several states, with similar rules, pressure from lawyers and lower courts, this pressure has led to the dissemination of so-called unpublished, non-precedential decisions via the Internet. Indiana took this step in August of 2006.
Next slide.
Some states, Ohio, have gone further and erased the distinction between published and unpublished precedential and non-precedential decisions. Kansas has yet to take the first step.
Next slide.
In Kansas, unpublished decisions are available, but only upon request from the Supreme Court Law Library. Apparently, however, they are regularly requested by Thompson, for they appear in full text in Westlaw. Not in Lexis, not in Casemaker, or any of the other online systems. Recall that Westlaw is the system used by Kansas appellate judges, but that district judges don't necessarily have access to it. With a medium that does not require selective dissemination, the case for distinguishing between appellate decisions that are precedent and those that are not on the basis of print publication is difficult, if not impossible, to make. And the consequences of continuing such policies are particularly troubling when unpublished, non-precedential decisions are in fact available through one, but not other, commercial dissemination channels.
Next slide.
The same capacity and cost concerns that led U.S. jurisdictions not to publish appellate decisions, except selectively, led most not to publish trial court decisions, excluding them completely from the precedent system. Trial courts are, of course, governed by vertical precedent flowing down from the appellate courts, but they're generally not seen as producing precedent themselves in any form. Yet the experience of those jurisdictions that do publish some trial court decisions, and examples from others where local distribution channels such as legal newspapers, bar publications, and in recent years, websites. In those jurisdictions where trial court decisions are available, courts and counsel get access to them and find value in their use as precedent in the looser, non-binding sense. And of course, we know from the U.S. District Courts, whose decisions are available, have been printed, and are available even, many of them, in unpublished format online, that they have value, that they're widely cited. There are legal domains in which important legal issues are repeatedly litigated without ever being appealed to a court whose decision may qualify for publication in a print law report. Providing access to trial decisions is feasible in the digital age, and that access can not only provide trial judges with useful guidance in situations where they're not bound by vertical precedent, but can also, I suggest, furnish appellate courts with a picture of how trial courts collectively, not just the trial court whose opinion is on appeal to it, how trial courts collectively have handled a perplexing issue. Here's one example. Whether data available from an automobile's black box can be admitted as evidence of the vehicle's speed without a prior hearing on the reliability of such devices has been addressed by appellate courts in a number of states, but not New York. The question must therefore be faced by New York trial courts without the direction of vertical precedent. But because trial court decisions do circulate in New York, including significant numbers beyond those selected for publication in the print official reports, any New York lawyer or judge confronting this question can find guidance in at least three unreported trial court decisions.
Next slide.
Another opportunity opened up by the digital era. Most state court websites, like that of the United States Supreme Court, offer digital files designed to replicate paper slip opinions. That has the advantage of consistent pagination and format. Indented quotations are indented. Emphasized text is shown in bold or italics. Maps, photographs, and other graphic materials displayed in context. And the dominant format is PDF. That approach, which exhibits the continuing hold of the print paradigm, is seriously deficient for documents designed to reach readers by means of a database.
Next slide.
Taking digital dissemination seriously requires encoding the structure, not simply the appearance, of opinions. Separating such distinct data elements as Westlaw and Lexis have taught us that we should be able to search on syllabus, judge, date, linking to cited references, revealing the structure of the opinion's legal analysis is outlined by headings and subheadings. The data standard capable of doing all this, XML, is now built into most forms of text handling software from Word and WordPerfect through PDF to contemporary web browsers. It needs to be used. Taking this largely invisible step can have a positive effect on the usefulness of court websites, can reduce the cost of redistribution through commercial systems, and, an optimist might imagine, have a long-range beneficial effect on the analytic structure of judicial opinions.
Next slide.
Another opportunity. Courts are now actively deploying computer-based case and file management systems, encouraging and even requiring electronic filing of briefs and other case documents, recording oral arguments. Increasingly, those reading a judicial opinion will be able to read it against the full arguments made by counsel, the record on appeal, and even statistical data on the judge's dispositions in similar cases. Some of these elements, which give the promise of adding depth to precedent, are already taking shape.
Next slide.
Color, images, video, audio. Over a decade ago, the United States Supreme Court delivered an important trademark opinion in Qualitex versus Jacobson Products. Writing for a unanimous court, Justice Breyer construed the language defining the reach of the Lanham Act, word, name, symbol, or device, as encompassing color. Qualitex had registered a special shade of green gold as a trademark for pads it sold to dry cleaning firms. The litigation that brought this issue to the court arose when a competitor, Jacobson, began selling pads of a similar color. Prior law on this point was far from settled, but market realities had already broken down narrow readings of the Lanham Act.
Next slide.
Does it seem natural to you, or as awkward as it has come to seem to me, that the court's decision explored and ruled on the role of color, identifying the Qualitex brand of pressing pads without including a full-color picture of this green-gold object and its similar competitor?
Next slide.
The Supreme Court's decision 3 years earlier in Two Pesos versus Taco Cabana dealt with the question whether inherently distinctive trade dress is protected by the Lanham Act without a showing that it has acquired secondary meaning. The factual background of that case was a jury finding that Taco Cabana's restaurant decor described here by the court had not acquired secondary meaning but was inherently distinctive.
Next slide.
Wouldn't this critical concept of trademark law, largely worked out in words, have been more effectively pursued and communicated by the court had it been able to see, in briefs, and use, in its opinion, graphic images? The world to which law and therefore precedent must relate has color, shape, texture, and sound. The technology and economics of print law report publication have effectively limited precedent to text. How text-bound is U.S. precedent? Out of the many thousands of federal court decisions decided in 2006 and loaded into Lexis, I count only 33 that include a chart, map, photograph, or other graphical element. The count for last year's state court decisions on Lexis is 11. A moment's reflection on today's web environment makes it clear that digital dissemination of precedents, once liberated from the economics and technical limits of print, can change that. What would it mean for opinions to be able to use images, color, and sound? If precedent is more colorful and more tuneful, might it follow, as some have suggested, that it might be less abstract, less conceptual?
Next slide.
Well, there are more, but I will end my list of potential opportunities and turn to the obstacles. All these changes in how precedent functions and how it is understood are attainable and over time, I think, nearly inevitable. None of them will come soon or easily or uniformly across the United States. Sources of inhibition, incapacity, and affirmative resistance are numerous. Let me list a few and quite obvious ones. Old habits die hard, especially when they're embedded in institutional structures. Techniques for working with and referring to precedent are learned in the first year of law study. I don't have to remind you of that. As quickly as possible, they're mastered to the point of becoming background tasks to be performed with a minimum of conscious effort. To all those generations who learn to research law in print law reports and to cite using page numbers, electronic versions delivered online are most comfortably thought about in relation to that prior form. And learning a new form of citation can seem as daunting as changing a golf swing or mastering a non-QWERTY keyboard, and unnecessary. Second, powerful commercial interests, as I think I have shown you, have a strong stake in holding back these changes and maintaining the judiciary's deep dependence on the private sector for precedent dissemination, including such core functions as citation, quality assurance, other editorial enhancements, and archiving. Third, while we may speak of judicial systems, many are not. Systems, that is. Functioning systems. Adapting the model of state responsibility for dissemination of precedent represented by the distribution of public law reports to judges and the operation of public law libraries, adapting these to the reality of online law requires a level of jurisdiction-wide administration and funding found in not all states. Even in states like Kansas, where trial courts do fall under a significant measure of state control and funding, decisions about funding of online research services, together with other support costs, can remain a county or judicial district responsibility. The most complete embrace of digital dissemination to precedent has occurred in those states where responsibility for meeting the legal information needs of all judges throughout the state, not merely those hearing appeals, is centralized with a court system that is unified in reality, not just in name. And judges. Judges are, and ought to be, busy being judges. In the press of performing that distinctive role, systemic issues of citation and case law dissemination may seem peripheral at best. Those judges who hold key leadership and administrative responsibilities are, in most instances, served by high-end legal information systems and may therefore have limited appreciation of the diffuse burdens of cost and inconvenience experienced by small firm lawyers and trial judges. The good news is that within the experimental space created by our nation's 50-state federal structure, vision, leadership, and capacity have already aligned in a number of states to furnish us with at least a foretaste of what president in a digital age can look like, and to provide solid examples or prototypes on which other states and the federal courts can, and I hope will, draw. I call that good news, for I am convinced that rendering the dissemination of precedent more efficient, more effective, and less costly to all, while expanding and deepening its scope, giving it image, color, and sound, are challenges worthy of scholarly attention and public leadership. But I should let Chief Justice McFarland of the Kansas Supreme Court have the last word.
Next slide. In the 2006 State of the Judiciary message, after outlining plans for a system that will furnish public access to court records from throughout the state, she wrote, "We live in the information age. It is vital and exciting to bring the Kansas court system into this new age and to do it right and by the most efficient means."